get everything to work here. Welcome to Sabbath School. We're so glad that you remembered that we still have a Sabbath School class here after being gone for a couple of weeks. Our lesson this time will be number 12 from the series on Genesis and entitled From Prison Cell to Palace. Before we get started with the lesson, our deacons are in place. Let's have a word of prayer and take up our offering so you'll remember that we're at Sabbath School, and then we'll get started. Our kind and loving Father, once again we turn to your word, to the messages and reports and stories recorded for us in the Bible. Help us to learn the things that you want us to learn from these stories, to recognize these biblical characters for what they were, real people with challenges like we have, but people who found that a relationship with you made their lives livable. May we follow their example, is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. It's interesting to notice that the title this time doesn't begin to cover the material in the lesson. From prison cell to palace, how long did that take? One day, as far as we know. But the lesson covers years. So this is not nearly the whole story of our lesson. From prison cell to palace is just one tiny little part of it, one of the interesting parts of the story. But let's just back up and just review briefly where we are here. You can see it on the screen. In this lesson, we shift from talking about Mesopotamia to Canaan, all that sort of stuff. Now we're talking about Canaan to Egypt. So you remember that in Jacob's life, he went from Canaan to Mesopotamia, back to Canaan, and down to Egypt where he finally died. So now we're talking about the stage where he's going from Canaan to Egypt and all the events that were connected with that and his children about that time. Our quarterly does not just touch it, just mentions very briefly the first three chapters here. I thought we should mention them because I don't think God put them in for a reason. Dinah is raped in Genesis 34. You remember briefly the story, how she went out, and you can understand, I think, why a young lady, probably early in her teens, or maybe not, maybe still, well, probably early in her teens, we can't nail these ages down exactly, might want to have some other girls to play with once in a while instead of 12 brothers. So she went to one of the local towns, and of course while she was there was attacked, and I shouldn't say that. Probably initially it was just a attraction, and became very friendly with some of the people there, and this Shechem took her and raped her. And then, you know, Dinah's older brother said, none of that. And we're not talking about people who are 40s and 50s here. These guys are in their early 20s when they do this. Maybe still teenagers when this happened to Dinah. And the two teenagers managed to go and wipe out this entire town. Don't know exactly how they did all of that, but they did. Jacob was very worried that, you know, things would be really bad if he gets that kind of reputation around in the area. But that's not all. Judah leaves home, decides to live with one of the local families for a while, marries a Canaanite wife, has three children. Two of them, the oldest one of Jacob's children, marries another Canaanite lady. He did something. We have no idea what he did. Says God didn't like what he did, apparently, and killed him. And then, following the Levirate rule that you know about, Levirate means brother-in-law, and according to Jewish tradition anyway, Hebrew tradition, the brother was supposed to sleep with the widow and raise up at least one son for his brother who would carry on the brother's name. And Onan, the second son, he didn't want to do that. He
did his own thing, and God killed him as well. You wonder what's going on here, don't you? Because after all, I mean, this is the line that's going to end up being the royal line. I mean, this is the house of Judah. Okay? And his two firstborn, number one and number two sons, were killed by God, according to the scriptures, if we believe what it says there. Well, that unfortunately is not the end of the story. You remember that for whatever reason, Jacob said to Tamar, well, you go back home and live in your father's house until my other son is old enough to marry you, and then you can marry him. And back home, she stayed for a considerable period of time and realized that son number three was old enough now to marry, but Judah wasn't making any move to let her marry him. And so what does he do? Well, one of those wonderful stories in the Bible, Genesis 38, she's the one who does something first. He's just going on his way looking for his sheep, and he's moved into Canaanite society. I mean, let's admit it. Judah has moved into Canaanite society. Now he moves back to his family later, but basically he's integrating with them, and we're going to think about what that implies a little bit later. So here he is, and he decides to sleep with this girl he thinks is either a real prostitute or maybe a religious prostitute alongside the road. A few months later, he finds out that she's pregnant, wants to have her killed, says, "What in the world are you doing, you awful thing?" And you remember, she says, "Well, the one who got me pregnant owns these things." And Judah says, "I'm sorry, that was my fault." And so he takes her to his house and takes care of her, but he never slept with her ever again. As far as we know, she never remarried. There's no evidence that Selah or any of his subsequent children, I guess he wouldn't have had any other except her children, so she never had a chance to marry, but he did take care of her. She became a part of this Canaanite woman became a part of the heritage of Judah, the heritage of Jacob, and so forth, which raises the question, how much do you know about Reuben's wife? Levi's wife. I mean, go down the list. How many of these wives of the 12 sons of Jacob, how many of them do we know anything at all about their wives? Here's your quiz for the morning. How many of the wives of these 12 sons of Jacob do we know anything at all about? Anything at all? Nobody's going to help me? Well, there's three that we know a little bit about. Sort of. I hedge my statement there. We know that Judah's first wife, she's called in some places in the Bible, she's only mentioned a couple of places. One place she's called Bathsheba. Another place they translate it and call her the daughter of Shua. So we don't know her name, we just know that she was a daughter of Shua. She's the one who gave birth to the three sons, who two older ones died, then she died, and so the only thing that was left of her was the third son, who became one of the descendants was one of the later tribal descendants of Judah. Then Judah's oldest son married this Tamar, and they could not possibly have been more than just teenagers when that happened. By the way, how old was Jacob when he had his first child? Anybody been reading ahead in the 85? Jacob was 85 before he had his first child. You can read it down there. It tells about under number two about. Well, just look at that for a second. Then we'll go back to the story of Tamar. Jacob was 120 at the death of his father, because we have, the Bible says specifically that Isaac died at 180. Jacob was 60 when, I'm sorry, Isaac was 60. Here it says Isaac was 60 years old when his two sons were born. So Jacob was 120 when his father died. 10 years later, at the age of 130, he stood before Pharaoh in Egypt. And there's the verse. At that time, Joseph had been governor of Egypt for 9 years already. Jacob was therefore 121 years old when Joseph was promoted at the age of 30. So Jacob was 89 when Joseph was born, and 108 when Joseph was sold at the age of 17. Consequently, Isaac was 168 years old when Joseph was sold into slavery. Since this tragic event occurred while Jacob was living at Hebron with his aged father, Isaac witnessed the grief of Jacob and survived that event for a period of 12 years. And that would be the loss of Joseph. He thought he had been killed by the wild animal and so forth. All that stuff, all that intrigue and so forth, Isaac was still living. 168 when that happened. Don?
Well, I was just kind of curious. Of course, when Jacob took off, he was separated from Isaac. Mm-hmm. And the only son that Isaac had was Esau. Mm-hmm. So did he kind of trust Esau? I mean, did he... When did he leave Esau and go to Jacob then?
Well, the record we have is that Esau moved down south and east and established his own basically kingdom and household and so forth in what was later to become the land of Edom, the descendants of Esau. But he came back from time to time to visit his father. When Jacob came back from Mesopotamia to Canaan, after he'd been there for a little while, he actually moved and stayed with his father because his mother, of course, was already dead. So he came down and stayed with his father. So while Esau was not too far away, I mean, what, 30, 40 miles, something like that, away in his own territory, it was still a couple days' journey by foot to cover that distance. So Jacob moved back home, and Esau had moved away. Okay, well, microphone again. Hold on. And another mic here. Would you, just a second.
Hold on. Book, I can't remember who wrote it now, that Joseph, when he was taken to Egypt, went through a tremendous number of activities there that were really quite unique, that he retained his faith and all. And mm-hmm. That was credited to the fact that he had become a good friend of his grandfather, who was Isaac. He was the one that was taken. I don't know whether...
Well, presumably, as far as the best evidence we have, is that Jacob was, and I think I may have that written down here somewhere. Jacob... Maybe that was part of the stuff I didn't write down. But anyway, Joseph lived with his grandfather Isaac, or with his father, presumably near Isaac, from an adolescent until age 17. So we don't know. Maybe 10 years he lived with Isaac.
And if that were the case, why, he may have been inspired enough to undergo all the trials and tribulations he had after he'd been sold to the Ishmaelites and on into Potiphar's house.
We need to think more about that in a moment. Don?
Well, then, because I was thinking, you know, this thought that we usually get what our goal is. And mm-hmm. Esau's goal was not for the spiritual benefits, but the double portion of the temporal. Mm-hmm. But tell me something. If Isaac ended up with Jacob, did he still get the double portion?
I've looked up that. I have not found anything in Ellen White or the Bible that spells that out at all. I have no idea. Probably by the time if Isaac was basically blind at age 100 and lived to be 180, and his two sons, who were both wealthy, living around him, I doubt that by the time he died there was much estate left. He was probably, they were taking care of him. He wasn't taking care of them. So that's the only conclusion I have been able to come to. So I'm just bringing in all this stuff to try to sort of help us to get the picture a little bit more. So this is a family who a couple of generations didn't have children until they were in their 80s and 90s. And then the next generation is having children and living and dying and marrying in their teens. I mean, just think of the differences in attitudes and so forth, at least as we understand them, that would be involved in that situation. Well, so we go back to the story of Tamar. So Jacob sleeps with her, and she becomes pregnant, has twins, and one of those twins ends up being the ancestor of Jesus. Now, the real question to raise here, a couple of very significant questions to raise here, are this. If you were the only person who ever lived in the history of our world who had a choice to pick out your ancestors and had a choice to determine what is known about those ancestors, because Jesus had both of those choices, right? Didn't he? Isn't he the one who decided what's going to be recorded in this record? He came along and said, yeah, I'm going to be born in this family. If you had those choices, would you have recorded the story of Tamar and recorded the story of, we're going to get on to Bathsheba and all these other things. Would you have recorded those stories? Don't we usually try to sort of hide the quote black sheep in our families? You know, what's going on here? Why did God go to considerable detail to record all of this stuff about his ancestors? Don?
Well, that gives us hope, maybe not to the same extent, mm-hmm. but we fall into the same traps, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, self-indulgence, selfish ambition, self-confidence, you know, we don't need a savior and all this. But one thing I can say about Judah, that maybe why God chose him to be the progenitor, is because he was... We often say what God wants is an honest person
yeah.
that's willing to follow truth wherever it leads, no matter who he is
mm-hmm.
and her. And he said when he recognized that this woman, Tamar, she was more righteous than he was. He was enough to admit it.
Which is, I mean, we understand his point of view, but who was the one who decided to behave like a prostitute? I mean, does that make her more righteous? You know, I mean, we think about these things. Yeah, we got a hand over here. Right there. You know, trying to make these people real, not just some imaginary people that aren't, you know, our real kind of people. Yes.
Also because we look at Christ, and if he had no bad people in his background, we would say, well, we can't be perfect. Because, you know, we've got this heredity problem.
Mm-hmm.
But he had the problem with his genealogy and the sin, you know, in his genealogy. So we can't use that as an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I'm going to just put the question very straight to you. Forgetting about Jesus for a moment and his part of the story, why do you think Moses was either inspired by God or himself decided to put... Let's just take the story of Tamar here, right? It's right in the middle of the story of Joseph. He starts the story of Joseph, and then all of a sudden there's a break. One chapter, the story of Tamar and all the stuff we've been talking about, and then he goes back to the story of Joseph. Why put it in there? Why do you think it's in there? Somebody's got to have some kind of an idea. Oh, here. Good. Lloyd. There's the microphone. Hold on.
Perhaps we might turn the question around and put it, why did it take Moses in the wilderness or for a whole lifetime, practically, before he went back to Egypt? There must have been something in special genetic trait all the way from Abraham on down through that we don't really know too much about.
Yeah, exactly. Sylvia.
Well, I can tell you what I've used the story of Tamar for.
Okay.
And that is to teach young ladies that there is a difference in our dress. She dressed mm-hmm. as a prostitute. Sitting on the side of the road would not have attracted attention, but she dressed as a...
Yeah.
She put on the outfit or whatever it was that mm-hmm. let them know that she was...
Well, it says she put a veil over her face, but clearly she identified herself probably...
Yes.
The veil probably indicated a religious prostitute. And remember that the Canaanites, they were famous for religious prostitution. That's what their religion was all about in those days. And God says, okay, I'm going to give you a certain period of time to try to, you know, straighten your act up. And they didn't, and they perished. And it was because of this kind of behavior. So now, here's a lady who takes on the kind of behavior that we're not supposed to copy. She copies it and ends up being a progenitor of Jesus. We say, God bless her, she's righteous. I mean, let's think about this. What's going on here?
Just to show us that we're all humans, I think. She sat out there and he went after her. Yeah. She dressed like that to get his attention, yes, but she wasn't really doing so.
Yeah, as the text says, he came along later. He sent his friend over there later to bring the little goat as a payment. And they said, there's never been any religious prostitute around here of any kind. What are you talking about, you know? So it's a very interesting story. And that helps to make a setting of, and it raises some other questions down here. What would have happened, number four on your handout, what do you think would have happened to the descendants of Israel now, or Judah, I'm sorry, Jacob, if they had not left Canaan? What would have happened, do you think? Lorna, someone's going to help me here.
They probably would have been assimilated into the Canaanite culture, and this was just, you could see it all on their fringes, and it would have just taken over.
Okay, which raises the next question. These saints who went down into Egypt as a part of Jacob's family, there were all these brothers, their wives, and their children. Where did those wives come from? We've already asked that question once, sort of, but I want to press that. We know Jacob's wife was what kind of a person? Where did she come from? I'm sorry, not Jacob's wife, Joseph's wife. Yeah, she was a daughter of the high priest in Egypt. So she was an Egyptian.
And that was spiritualism, wasn't it?
Well, all kinds of funny things. I mean, those people thought they were God and other things like that. We know about the two wives, I'm saying in quotation marks, of Judah. We've talked about them, his first wife and then the temporary wife, or whatever you want to call her, that later gave birth to most of his descendants, Tamar, who were both Canaanites. What do we know about the rest of the sons of Jacob and their wives? And the answer is zero. We know absolutely nothing about them. And the only logical conclusion is they probably were all Canaanites. And if God had left them there in Canaan, how long do you think it would have been before they would have just melted into the Canaanite culture? We would never have heard from them. So there's a reason why they went down into Egyptian captivity, and we're going to talk about this next time, but what happened to them, just briefly, what happened to them when they went down into Egyptian captivity? Why? Okay, they were kept separate. Why were they kept separate? Here, let's get the microphone. There you go.
The Egyptians were vegetarians, weren't they?
No.
But
Egyptians
anyhow,
were
they
not
hated shepherds.
They hated shepherds. Why did they hate shepherds?
Sheep ate all the grass, turned back to the ground.
No, not because of the way sheep ate the grass. It was because of the experience of Abraham with the previous Pharaoh when he lied about his wife. I mean, it says that very clearly in Ellen White. So God is setting things up. That whole experience, we look at that story and say, whoa, you know, why did that have to happen? Why did they have to have a famine in Canaan? Why did Abraham lie about his wife or not tell the truth about his wife anyway? She goes there. And as a result, the Hyksos, who were the ruling, they were not Egyptians really, but they were the ruling group, the foreigners. Hyksos means foreigners. They were ruling Egypt at that point in time, were probably Semitic in origin and more closely related to the Israelites, to the descendants of Jacob, than they were to the Egyptians. But nevertheless, they were ruling Egypt at that point in time. So this, they set up this rule. Don't have anything to do with shepherds. So look, a few years later, here comes Jacob and all of his crew, and they're shepherds, and so they get put in a separate corral, in effect, and kept separate, and that's the way that God manages to keep his people, quote, slightly pure, or separate from others. Yes.
Dr. Hart, I've often heard that Jesus, or God, makes good come out of bad. So what you're telling me is out of Abraham's lie, God made something good to keep him separate.
Yep. That's what happened. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. We got any more comments? I mean, we're telling strange stories here, but... Okay. Having said that, there's another one more chapter we need to mention just briefly before we get into the details of the Joseph story itself. In chapter 36, we have a recounting of the descendants of Esau. Now, a few chapters back, we had a chapter recounting the descendants of Ishmael. Now we have a recounting of the descendants of Edom or Esau. What happened to these other two groups? Ishmaelites were descendants of Abraham. The descendants of Esau were descendants of Abraham and Isaac. What happened to them? Do we have a Bible written about them? No. Basically, other than a few passing comments later on to the, I mean, I shouldn't say a few passing comments. There's a fair number of places where they're mentioned in passing. But they're always mentioned as evil, wicked people and so forth. Why does this family of Jacob get picked out? Now, don't tell me it's because they were saints, because you know perfectly well they weren't saints. So now, why is this family picked out from amidst all those others? All, remember that Abraham had six other sons besides Ishmael and Isaac. Six other sons. What happened to them? Why is this particular line picked out? Well, you're going to say to me, well, because their descendants wrote a Bible. Okay. Does that make them saints? Why do you think, and you don't have to answer the question right now, but if someone has an answer, I'd love to hear it. Why was this family picked out by God? Because apparently they were. Lloyd, you're going to help me.
Of course, this is a slight variation from what your lead-off is here, but has it ever been established how the pyramids got built and by whom?
Well, there's no question about the fact that they were not built by the Israelites. They were built 1,000 years before the Israelites showed up.
Okay.
So they did not build the pyramids. Yeah. That was a group of people. Those pyramids were there way before the Israelites showed up. Yes.
Dr. Hart, your question is, to me, maybe the best way to answer it maybe for me is to say, if I was going to pick out a line of genealogy to where my son is, you'd have to pick somebody, and there isn't anybody perfect because we're not in heaven. And so he just picked one line, and that line is the one that went to Christ.
Flip a coin.
I mean, maybe that's simplifying it. But
now, you know that your Jewish friends would hang you for saying that. Because what did they think? All through the Old Testament, they believed that they were chosen because they were special.
Well, they were.
Were they or were they not? I mean, that's what we're asking here. Don.
These people were the descendants of Abraham. The promise had been given.
All the people we're talking about, the descendants of Ishmael, all the other six sons of Keturah, all of them were, Esau's descendants were descendants of Abraham.
But the promise had been given to Abraham.
Yeah, and then to Isaac, and then to Jacob.
And then to Jacob. So this is the line that carried.
So if you don't get the promise given to you, you're out.
I didn't say that. You're saying that.
I'm just trying to make sure you say what you really mean. What are we talking about here? I mean, I agree with you. Clearly, It went from Abraham, and the promise was repeated to Isaac, and the promise was repeated to Jacob, and then it stops. We don't have any, there's no place where it says this promise was repeated to Judah, or this promise was repeated to Joseph, or any of the generations afterward. We have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. So what happened after that? Ken.
Maybe at that point God just chose what was available when the time came.
Well, I mean, sometimes you have to do that. You just pick whoever's there that's willing to listen, maybe. And I have to mention Dinah. We've already mentioned the fact that she got raped. What happened to her after that? Is there any evidence that she ever married? Is there a tribe of Dinah that became... She went down into Egypt, apparently, with the rest of the family. As far as we know, she never had any descendants. So, anyway, this is just to sort of paint a little background for us so that we, you know, think about what kind of circumstances Joseph came out of. So now we have Reuben mentioned there. You know the story. It's here on your handout back up here. If we go back up to it a little bit. Reuben slept with this lady who was old enough to be his mother, and was one of the secondary wives of his father, and that led to his being discredited. Maybe I should make that in bigger. Hold on, what's going on here? Oh, here we go. While Jacob was living in that land, Reuben had sexual intercourse with Bilhah, one of his father's concubines. Jacob heard about it and was furious. Okay, that's the story. And this is given as the reason why Reuben didn't receive the birthright as the firstborn son. There were other issues. But now think about this. This is the story of Reuben. We've already discussed quite extensively the story of Judah. Why is Joseph so different? You know the story of Joseph, and let's just run through that real quick. You know, here was this young man. He was favored by his father. He was the firstborn son of the father's favorite wife, the one wife that his father had actually chosen for himself. The other three wives got chosen for him by default, sort of. It wouldn't be too surprising that Joseph was favored. Was this a case of just favoritism, or were there some real reasons why Jacob favored Joseph? Do you know? Well, let's read. Yeah, go ahead, Wally.
You know, within a person's mind, we can't read within inside of it. Mm-hmm. We just can't. But God can. And maybe that's the difference. Many times within ourselves, we don't know whether the person's sincere or not. A lot of times we do something, we do it wrong. And some people, you know, when they're asking for forgiveness or they're really sincere for what they did wrong, as far as sorry about it, we don't know. God does.
Okay. Well, look at these. I cheated here a little bit, and I got some inspired help. Look at these comments under number 8, for example. As these sons, and of course it's talking about the other brothers of Joseph, as these sons arrived at manhood, now we're talking teenagers here now, they developed serious faults. The results of polygamy were manifest in the household. This terrible evil tends to dry up the very springs of love, and its influence weakens the most sacred ties. The jealousy of the several mothers had embittered the family relation, and the children had grown up contentious and impatient of control, and the father's life was darkened with anxiety and grief. By contrast, we have these couple of comments under number 16 about Joseph. Now, the first one is from our teacher's Bible study guide. In Joseph, Jacob sees a thirst and hunger for God. Joseph has a far different character than his brothers. A spirit of godliness dwells in him. He is pure, joyous, active, diligent, morally earnest, gentle, faithful, and truthful. He takes to heart the story that his father tells of God's mercy and providence, and his heart yearns for God. Jacob sees the same love for God and his son that he himself holds so precious. No wonder Jacob loves him so. Now, that's not inspired, although I can tell you I'm sure it's based on inspired material. This is what Ellen White says. There was one, however, of a widely different character, and again now she's contrasting with the brothers, the elder son of Rachel, Joseph, whose rare personal beauty seemed but to reflect an inward beauty of mind and heart. Pure, active, and joyous, the lad gave evidence also of moral earnestness and firmness. He listened to his father's instructions and loved to obey God. The qualities that afterward distinguished him in Egypt, gentleness, fidelity, and truthfulness, were already manifest in his daily life. His mother being dead, his affections clung the more closely to the father, and Jacob's heart was bound up in this child of his old age, which certainly he was. By the time Joseph, we're talking about here, Jacob is more than 100 years old. He loved Joseph more than all his children. Now, if you had this group of children, what would you do? Should we blame Jacob for favoring Joseph? I mean, here's a father who really, through a lot of difficulties, has come to really rely on God and come very close to God and so forth. And out of these 12 sons, he manages to get one who seems to be of the same spirit. Okay, we got 3 or 4 hands here. Go ahead, Wally.
Well, you know, when the sons came to Egypt asking for food later on, what was their reaction? To me, they told the truth, boy, their sincerity was totally different.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I agree with that or not later on down the line. How do you react to that? Because they didn't hide anything. They told the truth. They were even admitted that they were at fault.
Yeah. So things did change, didn't they? Fortunately, things did change in the lives of these young men, it seems. Okay, we've got 2 or 3 hands here. Go ahead. Vernon.
In reference to speaking of favoritism, could we put the word respect there, that Jacob had great respect for Joseph? Favoritism means that you might spoil him. Do things.
Jacob wouldn't think of spoiling Joseph, right? Like giving him a special coat, nothing like that?
Well, it might have been, but I'm sort of inclined to believe that there had developed between Joseph and his father such a relationship that the father, that Joseph respected the father and the father respected the son, instead of being the kind of a favorite that, you know, he pulled all kinds of little tricks and the father overlooked it and allowed him. Sure, he loved him. Just briefly to say, Ellamy and I had the privilege to meet a lady up in Shelby, Montana, who is the mother of 19 children. And I asked her one day, I said, I want to find out from you, did you love all the children the same? She said, yes, but I respected some more than others.
Okay. That is the voice of experience. Okay, Ben?
Well, if we step back quite a ways here and take a look at the larger picture, the great controversy view on this, could we blame God for having a closer relationship with some folks than with others? Is it God's fault, or is it the fact that some people tend to cling to that relationship and therefore receive more of those evident benefits of that?
To put that in more, I'll be more blunt to put your point even more strongly. I think God and the whole universe is sitting up there, and every time they find anyone who is even partially responsible to the message, they're we found one, you know. They're desperate for people here on this earth to pay any attention to them. I mean, sure, exactly. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, belittle God in any way. Obviously, he's the sovereign and other kind of stuff. But, boy, you know, he needs all the help he can get from our angle. We got a hand way at the back there as well. Go ahead, Don.
We often hear it said, judge not that you be not judged. But it is all right to judge truth, righteousness, goodness, mercy, and all that. And I think God had to be, he can't rush someone into growth before what they're ready for. And Joseph, I think, was far more mature, we might say, than his brothers, even after they were honest about, you know, that they were at fault. Because when he exposes himself immediately, how do they react? Oh, now he's going to get even.
Yeah.
We often judge what someone else will do, what we would do if we were in their circumstance. Mm-hmm. So I think they were still very immature.
Yeah. And they were a lot older at that time.
Right.
Jane Ann.
Different children draw different responses from their parents. As Joseph is described in this paragraph, he must have given his father a great deal of pleasure, mm-hmm, and joy and a welcome relief.
Exactly.
From the household stress.
Yeah.
As the other sons watched and every encounter that they had with Dad was a challenge to Dad, it, mm-hmm, drew his most serious reactions. They could not help but notice what joy and pleasure Dad was experiencing when he was with the spoiled little brat brother, according to them.
Again.
Dad would have given them the same pleasure, the same joy, mm-hmm, had they have drawn that response from him.
Mm-hmm. And yet, go ahead, and yet let's notice that when the lines are finally distinguished and the period of time goes by, Judah's descendants end up being the royal line, Levi's descendants end up being the priests, and Joseph's descendants were the ones who led the way into rebellion. So,
is there some similarity when Jesus was on this earth? It seemed like he was favoring, yeah, Peter, James, and John, but was it a matter of receptivity on their part and formed that close bond?
Yeah, very likely. Yeah, very likely. Okay, Sylvia?
As a parent, sometimes you give a child something in reward for what they have done, and I can't help but feel like he did, that it was more of a respect to Joseph, not a spoiled brat, because giving him that coat said something. Mm-hmm. It said something to those brothers. Mm-hmm. This one is deserving of being the head of this
family.
And
they knew it.
And they knew it.
And that's the worst part. When your brother gets in, it takes an advantage of you, I mean, or gets ahead of you in the family, and you know he deserves it, that's even worse.
But they could have shaped up.
Yeah.
That gave them the opportunity to do,
yeah,
something,
yeah,
instead of rebelling against him.
Well, we're running out of time. I got to keep watching this. So we need to keep moving on in the story here. Lloyd, were you going to say something more?
I'm afraid I'd muddy up the water. I think I'll coat.
Okay. Okay. Well, we know that I'm not going to touch on the main details of the story. They're fairly familiar. We're trying to take some of the byways and add something to the story. We know what happened. Joseph was sent up there to Dothan, and then he went on. He walked many miles to find his brothers, see how they were doing. He was betrayed, thrown into a pit, taken out, sold to the Ishmaelites, and off they went on the way to Egypt. There's one question that has really puzzled me about this story. When those Ishmaelites went from there to Egypt, they were traveling on the royal highway. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but the main highway going from Mesopotamia down to Egypt. They went right by Jacob's tents. Why didn't, and maybe he did, but the question is, I mean, wouldn't the logical thing been for these traders to say, hey, we've got the favorite son here. We'll return him to his father. The father will pay us way more for this boy than anybody in Egypt would ever pay. Why didn't they take him back home?
You're messing up the story.
I'm messing up the story?
That's right.
Well, anyway, that's something for you to think about. Anyone want to help me with that question? Anyway, that's something for you to think about. Go ahead, Vernon.
The old expression, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Yeah, maybe, whatever. So he gets down there to Egypt. Now, go ahead.
If you read the book, God Sent a Man, it tells you that he saw his home from a hillside, from far away. So they didn't go close enough.
Oh, come on. Now, we can do better than that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were close enough. If those Ishmaelite traders really believed, the only logical answer I can come up with is that they had made some kind of agreement with the brothers that they would not take him back home. That's the only logical thing I can come up with, because if they had known, okay, you take an extra couple of hours walking over that way and you make triple the profit on your goods, they would have done it. I really believe they would have done it. Those guys weren't in it because they had some love for the brothers. They were looking for money. Yeah. Lloyd, and then Janie.
I'm inclined to agree with you that we don't know the answer. I think the answer lies out in a celestial arena.
Someday.
And I think during the 1,000 years which we're in heaven, we'll learn a hell of a lot more than we think we know now.
Yeah. I've got lots of questions. Anne-Marie, Jane Ann.
Was Jacob powerful enough that after he paid them what they asked, he could have also followed them and exacted retribution?
But, I mean, if they told the story, he would know that, I mean, certainly Joseph could have told the truth. He would say, this is not their fault. So, yeah, that's a possibility I hadn't thought about. So Jacob ends up down in Egypt, and he's sold to Potiphar. Potiphar almost certainly is one of these Hyksos, one of these foreigners, one of these Shemite, Semitic rulers of Egypt. And therefore, Joseph could speak to him probably quite comfortably in his language. I don't know how long it took Joseph to learn to speak Egyptian, but whatever. The question is now, thinking about the story of Judah, thinking about the story of Reuben, when Potiphar's wife begins to try to seduce Joseph, what would have happened if it had been Judah or Benjamin? Or any of the other sons, for that matter, as far as we know. And of course, that raises the question again, why is this son different? That's the big question. Why is this son so different? Yeah, Van, he's going to help me. There.
Could it be that Satan was really actively working in here to thwart the future?
Do we have to guess about that?
Of Joseph? That he was using every means possible to deviate Joseph from this path? Mm-hmm. That God was up there saying, now watch. I trust him. He's going to do the right thing.
But he couldn't say that about Reuben and Judah.
That's right. He couldn't.
Why could he say it about Joseph? See, the question, if these lessons are going to be useful to us, we need to say, okay, here's the son who shines. Okay, why does he shine? Now,
well, he had that relationship with his father, who had that relationship with God, and he had that relationship with God. He knew God, and he knew the character of God, and I think he says, you know, I know what's right, mm-hmm. and I'm going to do what's right. And he just, it's like Job, you know.
Maybe
God
he just
watch.
Wasn't attracted to Potiphar's wife.
I don't know. I didn't see her.
I have a question about the mothers.
Yeah?
They obviously were all fighting. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rachel wanted to have the firstborn and didn't. And then mm-hmm. there was competition back and forth. Yeah. Take my maid take, you know, so we can all have sons. Why was Joseph then, did mom?
If you had picked out, from what you know about the wives, if you had picked out the one who was going to have the sterling son, would you have picked out Rachel? I don't think so. I wouldn't have picked out Bilhah. Bilhah was her servant. Leah and Zilpah seem to be, we don't know a great deal about them, but they seem to be a lot more righteous from what we do. I mean, Rachel's the one who stole her father's gods. Vernon.
Well, maybe you've touched on it already, but when Joseph was sold into slavery, he developed a maturation. Mm-hmm. It excelled greatly. Mm-hmm. And so the things that were previously in his life as a boy now ripened into manhood. Mm-hmm. And he set a course that he would not deviate from. And with God's help, he was able to hold that.
Okay. Well, one of the things that we know clearly about the story of okay, got another hand down here. One of the things we clearly know about the story of Joseph and Jacob, too, if we go back to that, is that these two men matured rapidly under difficult circumstances when they were suffering. Is that a clue to what's going on here? Go ahead.
This is a little off the subject, but it's a little discouraging to me if Jacob had that close a relationship with God that only one out of his 12 kids turned out okay.
Well, is that true?
Well,
in the early years it was, yeah.
But that's a little scary.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, absolutely, you're right. Yeah, okay, Sylvia.
What's sad is that Joseph has to marry an Egyptian woman and end up with two sons that are not devoted to God as
yeah.
much as he was.
I mean, it's true. Yeah. You know, but then having said that, where else would he get a wife? Would you rather have a Canaanite wife?
It seems like Joseph had some distinct advantages. He was the best looking, and in when it's talking about with Potiphar's wife, he was well built, mm-hmm. and that, no, they don't say that about any other brothers. So that seems like a distinct advantage. You start out as a really attractive child, and you grow mm-hmm. up into a very attractive man. It's a benefit.
That was why Samson did so well, right? I'm sorry. I just had to throw that in. Well, what do we do with these stories? I mean, that's the question. It's a challenge. Well, we know. And the next question I want to ask is this. Okay, Joseph is down there in prison. And he's thrown in for a despicable crime. And I don't think there's anyone who questions, anybody who knows the customs of the ancient peoples, questions the fact that if Potiphar had really believed his wife's story, Joseph would have had his head off just like that. Okay? So, Joseph was thrown into prison to save Potiphar's name and the name of Potiphar's wife, not because Potiphar thought he was guilty. So now here he is in prison, and he gradually works his way up, and the prison guard realizes, hey, this guy can be trusted. I can relax a little more. I got somebody here who's responsible. Let him take some responsibility. Now, I'm going to raise another question for you I want you to think about. What would have happened if, when the famine hit and the sons of Jacob came down to Egypt, if Joseph had still been in charge of the prison? What if the brothers had been thrown in a cell and here comes Joseph as in charge of the prison saying, can I help you? I mean, imagine how would, you know, I'm just asking, because God could have worked it out that way too. Brian, were you going to help me? Are you going back or?
I was just going to speak of Joseph for a minute.
Okay.
It seems like important people come out with statements like, I had a dream. Mm-hmm. Or have a dream. I mean, telling his brothers, you know, and his father's father observed it, but they all mocked him. And I mean, God opened a way for things to happen that wouldn't have if he hadn't given him the dream.
What would you say if a 16-year-old son starts popping off with these dreams? You wonder if he's doing marijuana, right? I mean, you know, or mushrooms. you know, his father said, Joseph, I mean, this is ridiculous. What are you talking about? You know, what else could he say? Okay, so now we've got to get to the sort of the punchline here. Joseph interprets the dreams for these two prisoners. One of them is killed. The other one is taken back into the king's service. 2 years later, why did he need to go through two more years of prison life? But he did. And apparently, somehow or other, through all of this, Joseph matures. At the age of 30 now, all of a sudden he says, come to the palace, we need you to interpret a dream. And he shows up, and the king says, okay, here was my dream. Joseph hears the dream. He says, God can help you to interpret this dream. This is what it means. And remembering, of course, that this was a Hyksos ruler. He was a Semitic ruler. He wasn't an Egyptian. So he was a minority ruling down in Egypt. He says, you're the right guy. I mean, anyone who can come up with that kind of stuff obviously has some connections with the, yeah, something the rest of us don't understand. We want you to be in charge. And suddenly Joseph is prime minister of Egypt. What has he been through so far that prepared him for this job? And we only got a couple minutes, less than that, a minute or so left. Brian.
Having to deal with his brothers.
Okay. What else? Anything else?
He was a mediator with those and his father, and I'm sure his father's wives. And
his brothers didn't appreciate his mediation.
No, but he kept trying.
He kept trying, okay. Yeah, was there someone here that wanted to make a comment? Don? Myra, right behind you. Can you just hand Don the mic?
Well, a mediator, as I come to understand it here, is someone that reveals the character of God. That's what we need to know.
And the right kind of a mediator.
Right. Uh-huh. And helps us get the right picture of God. And I think he showed those principles, not only before his brothers and his own people, but even how he dealt with the Egyptians.
Yeah. Okay. Vernon, go ahead.
Well, I think there's something here for all of us to analyze carefully. You have Abraham. He has a dream. And then later on, you've got Jacob with one. And then you have Joseph with one. And you have Daniel. And what did all these men do?
They well, don't forget Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar.
Well, yes, but the very experience mm-hmm. of these things developed within them a character that made possible for them to stand up under yeah. great crisis.
Yeah.
And is not what we as a people at the end of time are to have?
Yeah. Well, what we see in this story, if I can just draw some conclusions here real quick, what we seem to see in this story is God is looking at certain lives. Particularly, we see the life of Jacob. We see the life of Joseph, and God sees in there a gem. And they have to go through some real polishing. I mean, they suffered. They went through difficulties. I mean, think of the life of Jacob, all he went through, and how here he arrives up there in Mesopotamia with nothing. Look at what Joseph went through. He goes down to Egypt as a slave. Both of them rose to magnificence, not because they were really good at business skills or something like that, but because they stayed close to God and they really depended upon that special relationship with God. I think we need to learn from this story at least that much, that you can come out of a cesspool, excuse my expression, but you can rise to be God's friend if you stay close to him and really decide that instead of doing the Reuben thing and instead of doing the Judah thing, instead of doing what, you know, the Dinah Shechem thing, if you do the Joseph thing and you, despite difficulties, stay true to God, you could count on it. God will turn around and bless you in ways that you can't possibly imagine. Let's pray. our kind and loving Father, what can we say about such interesting stories? We wonder what the children thought about these stories as their parents told them around the campfires and various times out there herding sheep or cattle as they repeated these stories, because no doubt this is where the stories were repeated most frequently. And yet today we believe there's a great lesson here for us. Help us to be faithful as was Jacob and was Joseph in our day, when we know that suffering is coming again. And we remember that you said through your prophet, through your apostle Paul, that those who live righteous lives will suffer persecution. Forgive us where we have failed you. Help us to live the kind of lives that will bring on persecution if that's what is needed to bring on your second coming, is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for coming.